Good morning. Today's passage is Genesis chapter 1, starting in verse 26 and concluding the chapter. Then God said, "Let us make man in our image, after our likeness, and let them have dominion over the fish of the sea, and over the birds of the heavens, and over the livestock, and over all the earth, and over every creeping thing that creeps on the earth." So God created man in his own image. In the image of God, he created him. Male and female, he created them. And God blessed them. And God said to them, "Be fruitful and multiply and fill the earth and subdue it, and have dominion over the fish of the sea and over the birds of the heavens and over every living thing that moves on the earth." And God said, "Behold, I have given you every plant yielding seed that is on the face of all the earth, and every tree with seed in its fruit. You shall have them for food. And to every beast of the earth, and to every bird of the heavens, and to everything that creeps on the earth, everything that has the breath of life, I have given every green plant for food." And it was so. And God saw everything that he had made, and behold, it was very good. And there was evening, and there was morning, the sixth day. This is God's word.
Well, may the words of my mouth and may the meditation of our hearts be acceptable in our Creator's sight today. So are we different than the animals? The Christian and world-renowned doctor and scientist Francis Collins, who up until recently was the director of the National Institutes of Health, once wrote that we are essentially stardust. That we and all creatures on the planet are composed of essentially the same elements that our very planet is made of. And he wrote, "You are quite literally stardust." But as Hamlet asked, what is this quintessence of dust? Are we more than dust? Well, one worldview would say, yes, we are more than dust by accident. We are, by infinitesimally small chance, more than dust. But the Bible's worldview would say, yes, we are more than dust by design, by the intent of a creator. So what we're going to talk about today really has to do with the worldview that we find here in this ancient creation account. And a worldview has been described as simply a philosophy of life, how you understand the world and life and how you should live it, okay? Have you ever thought about how an artist or an inventor or like a composer or an author will create great works, but always be striving and aiming to create their best work? The Russian author Dostoevsky was always trying to come up with like the perfect human being, like the picture of the perfect human being, and he really, the closest he got was his final masterpiece, The Brothers Karamazov. Think of Beethoven's Ninth Symphony. Think of Michelangelo's sculpture of David, right? Think of the Beatles' Abbey Road, which I kind of think was their masterpiece personally. But when you think of when you think of human beings, they're always trying to capture the best of what they can do. They're striving for that great masterpiece, their best work yet. Now in Genesis chapter 1, what we've seen over the last 2 weeks are phrases like this. God said, "Let the waters swarm with swarms of living creatures," right? And let birds fly above the earth across the expanse of the heavens. And then he would say that, then God said, "Let the earth bring forth living creatures." But creation's crown, in a sense, God's masterpiece, is about to appear on the canvas. The language changes from, "And God said, let there be," "and God said, let there be." It changes to this, "Then God said, let us make man in our image, after our likeness. And here we see yet another distinction within the created order. Humanity somehow is like God among all the creatures. Somehow humanity on this planet is like God. And at the end of this account, verse 31, we see that God saw everything that he had made, and behold, it was very good. It's the first time you see very. It was very good, and there was evening, and there was morning, the sixth day. Without humanity, creation was good. Creation was beautiful. Creation had purpose. But until humanity, creation was incomplete. As Chrissy told the kids this morning, until humanity, creation was incomplete. Why? There was nothing and there was nobody like God here. God meant for humanity to represent him on earth, reflecting his wisdom on earth, his goodness on earth, and even his love on earth. And so today we're going to talk about the biblical worldview of these things, of who we are as human beings and why we are here. And we're going to talk about, from the biblical worldview's perspective, humanity's nature, but also humanity's mission. A couple of years ago, we went through the Sermon on the Mount, and one of the themes we saw in the Sermon on the Mount that Jesus was trying to communicate to his hearers was identity makes impact. Identity leads to impact. Who you are will determine what you do. So humanity's nature, but also humanity's mission. And finally, humanity's renewal. Because as you can see, we've got lots of problems. So, humanity's nature, humanity's mission, and humanity's renewal from the perspective of Genesis chapter 1. So, humanity's nature is not an afterthought, but the final thought. When you read the ancient creation myths around the world, you read these dramatic stories about rivalries and little altercations between heavenly beings, and the result of the fights and the ideas and the trickery and the tomfoolery is humanity. We're kind of the byproduct of what they've got going on up there. Not so in the Bible. We're not an afterthought. We're the final thought. What does it mean to be human? What does it mean to be created in the image of God after God's likeness? Well, these words, image and likeness, are very important. So, thousands of years ago, a bunch of Hebrew rabbis before the time of Christ, a couple of hundred years before the time of Christ, they came up with a Greek translation to the Hebrew Bible because a lot of people spoke Greek in that part of the world 2,000 years ago. We call it the Septuagint, the Greek version of the Old Testament. It was probably the version of the Old Testament that Jesus and his disciples knew the best. Now, in that Greek translation, the word for image is literally the word icon. Does that sound familiar to you? The word icon, we've used it for centuries. Why would they use the word icon to say that we are the icon of God? Because ancient peoples believed that idols represented the gods, that a carved image, a graven image, in some way was where that God's spirit would dwell for the people around it. Even furthermore, Furthermore, the ancients believed that a king or a queen or a pharaoh or an emperor was the human representation of God, which is why they were ruling. You know, the ancient Romans thought that Caesar was divine, a son of the gods, as did the Egyptians with their pharaohs. And so this word, image, icon, is very important. It was very important to ancient peoples. And so what the Bible does with this image And actually, the phrase in Latin is imago Dei. It just means image of God. You see this come up a lot in theology. The Bible's imago Dei, the concept of the image of God, it employs those ancient cultural assumptions and ideas, but then it alters them. It reveals that all of humanity is God's vice regent of creation and all its creatures. Not just a pharaoh, not just a Caesar, not just a king or a queen, but humanity as a race is God's vice regent, vice president, so to speak, of the planet. When we read this, we should marvel like the ancient Hebrews marveled. Think of this. Imagine a nation of former slaves learning in this very verse that they were by nature royal. Think of a group of slaves learning, not by some human law, but by their very nature, they were royalty. What kind of hope would that have brought them? Can you imagine? So the word image is very important, as is the word likeness. Whereas all vegetation and all creatures, we are told, came into being according to their own kinds. Remember that phrase from last week? Humanity exists according to God's kind. To say we were created after God's likeness is saying, well, the plants and the sea creatures and the birds and the beasts of the earth are created according to their own kinds, and then humanity was created according to God's kind. This is profound. So how are we kind of like God? Well, theologians have three basic views about this, what it means to be created in the image and in the likeness of God. These are three views that I don't think should be looked as competing ideas, but they all work together. They complement one another. There's the substantive view, which basically says we're like God in the sense that we possess rationality and morality. We have a sense from culture to culture across all human history of right and wrong. And we are rational, unlike the animals. But also, there's a relational view. We have a tremendous capacity to be in relationship with one another and to lose relationship with one another. And more so, and most importantly, we have the capacity to be in relationship with the Creator. The third view is the functional view, and this is just as important. We rule the earth as God rules in heaven. Think of how Jesus said in the Lord's Prayer, "Your will be done on earth as it is in heaven." So here we see how man is moral and rational, but man is relational, and how also humanity is kind of supposed to administrate things here as God administrates the entire universe. And now Moses celebrates God's purposes for humanity with the Bible's very first poem. So God created man in his own image. In the image of God, he created him. Male and female, he created them. We should marvel just as much. Now remember, this is at least 3,000, if not more, years old, this statement. We should marvel at how both sexes rule. How before sin and brokenness, God created us in his image, male and female, kings and queens. We're going to come back to this in the coming weeks. So being human means to be like God. Like God, not God. Distinctions are important. To be human means to be like God, but not God, nor simply animals. Because of the amazing advancements in human genome sequencing, recent genome sequencing has discovered that the DNA of chimpanzees and human beings are 96% identical. And I know what you're thinking, that 4% means a whole lot. And it does, because we're like you know, we're orbiting the moon and sending rovers to Mars, and the chimps are still picking bugs off of each other's backs in the trees. But 96%, biologically speaking, we are very much the same. And I gotta be honest with you, a lot of my Italian relatives and friends from Long Island are almost as hairy as chimpanzees. So it makes a whole lot of sense to see that 96% that we have in common with their genome. But I want to say that even if we were 99.9999999% genetically the same as chimpanzees, we'd still be different ontologically. I mean, by nature, we would be different because God created us in his image, after his likeness. Therefore, we are very different from chimpanzees and orca whales psychologically, anthropologically, and socially. Now, spiritually, to be human means to have intimacy with God. You know, in the Babylonian creation myth, which is referred to as the Enuma Elish, human beings are really the servants of gods. Human beings are running around building temples for the gods, making food for the gods to eat, making sure the gods are happy. Deathly afraid to make sure that the gods are happy. But the author Marilyn Robinson, in her treatment of Genesis, notes something very important about Genesis. It's just the opposite. In Genesis, she says, it is God who is building a world for us. It is God who provides vegetation as food and nourishment for us and all the creatures. What is the nature of humanity? Not an afterthought, but God's final thought, God's masterpiece, Beethoven's Ninth Symphony. Not the first, not the fifth, not the seventh. Those were awesome. But the ninth, is what he's remembered for. And when we get to the end of the creation account, Moses says, you, male and female, are God's masterpiece. And the primary blessing of a God-given identity is a God-given mission. Preachers learn that you have to tell people what is true and what to do. And it seems like Moses was a good preacher because that's what he's doing here. Identity leads to mission. Our view of ourselves is going to impact how we live and what we do. So humanity's mission is to endeavor to rule creation with God's wisdom, with God's goodness, and in the love of God. Verse 28, we are told, and God blessed them. And God said to them, be fruitful and multiply, and fill the earth and subdue it, and have dominion over the fish of the sea and over the birds of the heavens and over every living thing that moves on the earth. Theologians call this the cultural mandate, which is essentially that humanity should rule the earth as its stewards, not its owners, its stewards, in obedience to God, who is its creator and its Lord. And this, the cultural mandate, Genesis chapter 1, verse 28, this is the ground. This is the foundation of all human endeavor. Everything we do, everything you can dream of, from agriculture to industry, from starting a business to designing the next bridge that's going to span the harbor over there in Baltimore, from the arts to the sciences, from just simply teaching third grade in school to changing diapers and picking those lush vegetables out of your own garden. All of it comes from the cultural mandate. Now, to rule what is not our own, remember, it's not our own, to rule what is not yours, to be a steward, not an owner, to be a steward, not a lord, You need to rule with wisdom and with goodness and with love. It's critical because it's not yours, and you don't want to mess up something that belongs to somebody else. You don't want to ruin something that someone else created by design with a purpose. You need wisdom. We need goodness. We need to do it lovingly. So this is where we understand our mission as those who believe in the God of the Bible. Believers grow into, if I can use the word grow, believers grow into what God intended humanity to be. We are his likeness here. We are his representatives on earth. Chimpanzees are beautiful. Whales are beautiful. You may love your pet, but we are God's representatives. Now, this worldview, again, a worldview is a philosophy of life. This worldview is the beginning. What I mean, this worldview is the foundation for all morality and ethics and justice. Where else would all of that come from? And regarding this worldview, I want to point out two really encouraging things that I think ground us in this life and help us as we teach others and disciple others and raise the next generation up. Two important things I want to mention in this cultural mandate: intended goodness, not accidental goodness, intended goodness, and intended intimacy. Not imagined, cooked up intimacy, intended intimacy. Intended goodness. People have always, for thousands of years, wrestled with the problem of evil, right? If there is evil, how could a God exist? That's a very good question. But the scientist and Christian and former pastor Greg Cuzzona points out, hold on, that is a very important question, the problem of evil. But there's an equally important question, the problem of good. If good exists, how can there not be a creator? Those are equally important questions that we have to ask and that we should balance in our quest for truth and meaning. What about the problem of good? Where does good come from? More than the problem of good, actually, it's a good problem. It's a blessing that there is good in the universe. We have to talk about intended intimacy. If we are by nature like God, then we are close to God, or at least we should be. This provides tremendous comfort. I want you to think about it. When you feel weak compared to the beasts, right? Have you ever run across a bear on a hike? Right? Like, even just the raccoons drive you crazy, right? Have you ever had a rat trapped in your garage? I don't know anybody like that. They get into your mind, right? The creatures are amazing. They have skills that we don't have, and we should marvel at the beasts of the earth. And yet, there's comfort here in Genesis chapter 1, verse 28, that when we look at the beasts and realize we are weak in comparison to them, there's comfort. When we look at these storms that are ravaging the planet and realize that we are helpless, when we look at the vast galaxies and the universe that apparently continues to expand and we feel absolutely infinitesimally small and microscopic and meaningless. When we look at the mountains, which have just been here for almost ever, and we realize that we're not going to last another 40 years. When we realize these things, we can find comfort in the intentional intimacy with God that we see in Genesis chapter 1. We have a shared intimacy with the eternal one, which is to live forever. Genesis touches base on something that we seem to have that science cannot offer evidence into in the animal kingdom, the human soul. So intended goodness and intended intimacy, this is a worldview that you can live by. And it is a refreshing alternative to the other worldviews that are competing with it in today's world. So, here's the worldview in a nutshell. Whatever plans your parents have for you, listen up, kids. Whatever plans your parents have for you, whatever plans your boss has for you, whatever plans your spouse thinks they have for you. Whatever plan America has for you, these all pale in comparison to God's mission. Now, you're all a bunch of smart people, and you realize at this point, when you look back on human history, and you look back on your own family's history, or the history of our nation, or the history of the ethnicity or the people group that you represent, you realize that for time out of mind, people have reimagined and recommissioned themselves after their own image, after their own likeness. We are very good at enforcing our own ideas of what it means to be human upon each other and even upon ourselves. When philosophers hundreds of years ago said, you know what, man is going to be the measure of all things, we replaced God in our thinking and our worldview. Parents do this to children, right? I'm going to fashion you in my image. I'm going to fashion you after my likeness. And I'm not talking about biology. Your children have your biology. What I mean is what you want them to be, what you want them to become. Parents do it to kids all the time. Leaders do it to their subjects, to their citizens. Bosses do it to their employees. Nations do it to nations. People groups do it to people groups. And we all do it to the planet, and we do it to the creatures. And this is not wise administration. This is not Genesis chapter 1, verse 28, the cultural mandate. This is selfish exploitation. When you read the news and you see the heights of human invention and how scary the most amazing inventions become when they get out of our control, right? Whether it's nuclear energy or artificial intelligence, right? We are so godlike that we create things that are absolutely amazing, and then we realize, wait a minute, we're not really like God, because the very things we're creating with our God-giving ability are now controlling us, and we can't control them. This is not to reign in righteousness, but to rule in wickedness, the very opposite of the cultural mandate. You know, John Lennon's famous song, Imagine, seems benign when you listen to it, and it's quite pleasant. Imagine there's no heaven. It's easy if you try. No earth below, no hell below us, above us only sky. But without God's purpose, which is what he was trying to accomplish, but without God's purpose in the world, a chaotic digression occurs. And we're going to see this happen in the next few chapters of Genesis. Or as the ancient teacher in Ecclesiastes said, God made man upright, but they have sought out many schemes. You don't have to be an atheist to rule in wickedness. All you have to do is impose your own will on another human being. As it turns out, sometimes religious people do this more than anyone else. We have to realize that humanity needs renewal, that each one of us desperately needs renewal. We are gloriously created in the image of God after his likeness, but we have taken that image and we have trampled upon it. And we need renewal, and creation needs renewal. And you know that, because so much has transpired in human history since that very good beginning, since that very good sixth day. So creation's and humanity's dire need for restoration actually gives meaning to the rise of Christianity in the world. As the ancient Christians, the first Christians, would say about Jesus of Nazareth, that he is the image of the invisible God. Now, the word image is the same word in the New Testament. It's icon. Jesus is the icon of the invisible God, the firstborn of all creation. Now, before you jump ahead and think, well, then Jesus must be like the angels or like superhumans. He's just like another created person, just the best. No, no, no. Keep reading. For by him all things were created, and he is before all things, and in him all things hold together. So on the Bible's terms, that's not a creature. That's God. Don't you see what Christianity is saying in light of Genesis chapter 1? God became a human being. God robed himself in the human genome. 96% similar to the chimpanzees, and yet not. Jesus robed himself, the eternal Son of God, in the human genome and ruled on this planet in wisdom and in goodness and with love. Jesus restored humanity's glorious but stained imago Dei, image of God. And you go, yeah, well, he was crucified. Yeah, he was crucified because as he said himself to Pilate, my kingdom is not of this world. His true kingdom is coming, and it will rule forever. The question is, will you also rule with Jesus? Because that is ultimately what you have been created to do. That is what you are designed to do, a queen, a king of creation. Will you rule forever with Jesus? Will you, as it also says in Colossians chapter 3, will you, through Jesus, put on the new self, which is being renewed in knowledge after the image, you guessed it, its icon, after the image of its creator? Do you see? If you haven't yet trusted Jesus, you need to, because your stained image needs it to be restored. Yes, you are glorious, but you are separated from your creator, and you cannot fulfill his mission for you apart from Jesus. To represent God's image as a human being, you must let Jesus represent you. And that's what it means to be a Christian. Jesus restored the image of God in humanity. And by becoming a part of the body of Jesus Christ, you become a part of the new humanity who will rule with Jesus forever. Why did Moses tell the Israelites, don't make images and worship them? Because we are the image. We are God's image on the planet. Why did Jesus come? Why did God become a man, a human being, to live perfectly and to die and to rise from the dead? Because the human image in you and the human image of God in me was broken and needed to be restored. God meant for humanity to represent him on earth. And thou, now, though incompletely, you represent God well again through Christ. And when he returns, you and I, and we with Christ, will represent him perfectly once again. So start now. Grow into what God has intended you to be as a mother, as a dad, as a grandparent, as a child, as a brother or a sister or a friend, as a coworker, as a Christian, as a member of this church, as a neighbor to somebody else. Grow into what God has intended you and commissioned you to be. His likeness here, his representatives right here in Carroll County, and yes, as Jesus said to the apostles, to the ends of the earth. That's what missions is all about, bringing the renewed representation and image of God, the likeness of God, to the ends of the earth so that all humanity can be renewed. And let's remember as we close what C.S. Lewis has told us. Once a king or queen of Narnia, always a king or queen. Let's pray. Our God, we are so grateful that you have chosen in your infinite wisdom and your kindness and mercy to relay this ancient wisdom to us. We confess it is hard to understand, but Father, it gives us hope. It gives us purpose. It gives us identity. Forgive us for refashioning and recreating ourselves, our children, our spouses, our coworkers, our friends. Forgive us for manipulating others into the image of what we want them to be. Help us to become more like you through Christ, your Son. We thank you that he reflected you perfectly. May we now learn to reflect him. May we present to others the image of Jesus. And may we help others, our neighbors, our friends and coworkers, our families, may we help them grow into the fullness of the image of Christ. In his name, amen.